This is side one of For the Record program number 561, titled Economics 911, Part 2, being recorded on July 16th of the year 2006. Before we get into the main body of the program, let me note that there is a vast and growing amount of information relevant to For the Record on the web, both audio files maintained both by Spitfire and by Heroic Sister Station WFMU. Those are available, and also a vast and growing amount of printed material, long article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows, old, long out-of-print, and copyright-expired anti-fascist books. So I can't encourage people strongly enough to take advantage of the enormous amount of material on the web, because those of you who only listen to the programs are only getting a small amount of the For the Record experience. Please note also that those of you who do take advantage of this information are most emphatically encouraged to use the Internet and other means of public communication to disseminate this information. That's what it's for. I don't get paid for what I do, and the idea, basically, is we're all in the same boat. It is sinking with great rapidity, and we've all got to start rowing and bailing. Otherwise, basically, we're all going to be shark food. So that's my advisory under the circumstances, okay? Alrighty, more about that time permitting at the end of this side and on side two. Now, this program, again, part two of Economics 911, is going to be dealing with some of the economic implications of not only September 11th, but related topics, the ongoing turmoil in the Middle East and some of the economic implications of same. Now, last week, we talked about the free market, laissez-faire economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood and how basically it is at one with the desires of the multinational corporate globalists. And in my considered opinion, the multinational corporate community, not necessarily corporate America, but the multinationals, the transnationals, and the element that dominates them, the underground Reich, the most powerful economic entity on earth, those elements very much want to promote the Muslim Brotherhood in order to supplant state-controlled economies in various areas. Specifically, although the Bush administration is in certain respects opposing the Muslim Brotherhood, some elements of the Bush administration are actively supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and Bush's, quote, democracy, unquote, program has led to the ascension of the Muslim Brotherhood in a variety of different societies, either their accession to total power or their significant increase in parliamentary representation. I suspect that Islamist/Muslim Brotherhood free market economic philosophies are targeted for areas like Syria, which still have a state-controlled economy, which is sort of like a hybridization of fascism and so is Stalinist socialism. So as a starting point for this discussion as well, we're going to talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, and we're going to review some of its fascistic ideology and connections. Veteran listeners will please bear with us here. I know you know about this, but this is a complicated line of argument. And indeed, For the Record is about as pedantic a radio broadcast as one could possibly want. And so in consideration of same, I'm going to repeat certain key points so that it's easier for people to keep them in mind. By the way, too, one should remember that political matters are not monolithic or simplistic. And if people are sort of confused by how elements of the Bush administration could be promoting the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamism in places like the Middle East, parts of the Middle East, and perhaps also at least some elements of U.S. intelligence appear to be backing the Islamists in Chechnya and in Xinjiang province in China in attempts to break off those mineral resource-rich parts of Russia and China, respectively. At the same time, one should not make the mistake that a lot of the conspiracy geeks, in particular the so-called the 911 BS movement, not the serious 911 researchers, but the BSers, the controlled demolition freaks and their ilk, they are maintaining that that Osama bin Laden, etc., are simply extensions of the CIA. They were trained and armed by the CIA, but that was a long time ago. And we are indeed fighting a very, very real war with those same elements. It is, in certain respects, analogous to World War II, when American fighting men and women and the other Allied fighting men and women were engaged in a very, very real, incredibly costly, bloody struggle against the forces of fascism, while significant elements of the world's power elites, including the Bush family, among others, were in bed with the fascists. Indeed, at the same time as the elder George Bush was being shot down by the Japanese in the Pacific, his father, Prescott Bush Sr., was basically bankrolling, banking money for the Nazis. One should not oversimplify this, and if some of what I'm saying seems puzzling, bear in mind what happened in World War II, because with Islamofascism, as with fascism in the World War II period, many of the world's power elite, the corporate elite, are playing ball with the very people that our fighting men and women are bloodily engaged with. So that may be something of a help. Reviewing the fascist connections, and in particular the fascist economic, the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, we are going to go back to the book Dollars for Terror by Richard Labeyviere. Richard Labeyviere published a remarkable book in French in 1999 and English in 2000, which in many ways not only anticipates the events of September 11th, but goes a long way towards helping to sort out some of the very confusing realities. We're going to begin here by taking a look at, reviewing some of the aspects of the Muslim Brotherhood. Before we get to the Brotherhood's corporatist philosophy, we're going to review some of the political history of the luminaries of the Muslim Brotherhood, including Sayyid Ramadan, the son-in-law of Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna, and also the father of Tariq and Hani Ramadan, who are being hailed by the so-called progressive sector in certain countries, including this one, as progressives, enlightened people, and so forth. They are nothing of the kind. And indeed, some of the savvy French counter-terrorist experts and investigators, certainly not people who could be called toadies of American imperialism, nor people who supported the preposterous Iraq invasion. Many of these individuals are hailing the Ramadans as heroes. In fact, they are nothing of the kind. Turning now to Dollars for Terror, of Sayyid Ramadan and the Muslim Brotherhood and their historical relationship to fascism, after discussing the fact that Sayyid Ramadan selected Munich as the eventual place for the Muslim Brotherhood to relocate in Europe, as well as Geneva, Switzerland, why Munich? Why Germany, I asked Rifat Sayyid. Because there, one finds old complicities that go back to the late 1930s when the Muslim Brothers collaborated with the agents of Nazi Germany. By soaking up the savings of these Muslim workers, meaning Turkish workers in Germany, Yusef Nada, like Sayyid Ramadan, took advantage of an extremely favorable context and used it as a springboard for the Muslim Brothers' economic activities. Yusef Nada, who calls himself the foreign minister of the Muslim Brotherhood, is the head of the Bank al-Taqwa, the Muslim Brotherhood's primary financial organ, and an institution that helped to fund al-Qaeda, according to numerous sources. Yusef Nada was also a Nazi spy in World War II, and Yusef Nada, through the SAR network and the Safa Trust, busted on March 20th, 2002, in the Operation Green Quest raids. Those networks link elements of the GOP and the Bush administration to the Muslim Brotherhood and former Nazi spy Yusef Nada, continuing with Richard Labeyviere's Dollars for Terror. But Yusef Nada is even better known to the Egyptian intelligence services, who have evidence of his membership in the armed branch of the fraternity of the Muslim Brothers in the 1940s. At that time, according to the same sources, he was working for the Abwehr under Admiral Canaris and took part in a plot against King Farouk. This was not the first time that the path of the Muslim Brothers crossed that of the servants of the Third Reich. The history of the fraternity makes the Brothers' concept of the Islamic State clear, a theocratic state of fascistic inspiration. Some of them were fellow travelers of the Nazis and are still trying today to resuscitate the old alliance of Islamism and the swastika. And the next reference here is to Muhammad Sayyid al-Ashmawi. He is an Egyptian journalist who has been the focal point of a great deal of threatening behavior and even at some point incarceration for his opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that the brothers themselves are less than completely welcomed by the Mubarak government. Mohammed Saeed al-Ashmawi continued, quote, "All my research always brings me back to the same point. At the beginning of this process of the perversion of Islam are the Muslim Brothers, an extreme right cult." An extreme right cult? Quote, "The history of the Muslim Brothers is infused and fascinated by fascistic ideologies," Saeed al-Ashmawi adds. "Their doctrines, their total if not totalitarian way of life, takes as a starting point the same obsession with a perfect city on earth in conformity with a celestial city whose organization and distribution of powers they can discern through the lens of their fantastical reading of the Quran." This fascistic affiliation, unquote, would crop up in the analyses of several of our interlocutors, in particular that of the journalist Eric Rouleau, who is a specialist in the Middle East and the former French ambassador to Tunisia and Turkey. Skipping down. Lastly, the emergence and the rise to power of fascism, hostile to French and British colonialism, gave rise to many analogies with corporatist propaganda and the methods of mobilization of Mussolini's gangs, unquote. And more about the doctrine of Muslim Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna. Islam is doctrine, divine worship, the fatherland, the nation, religion, spirituality, the Quran, and the sword. And more about the fascistic economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's again skipping down from Dollars for Terror. Taking Italy's choices under Mussolini for inspiration, the Brotherhood's economic program set three priorities. The social policy foresaw a new law on labor founded on corporations. This economic program would more directly reveal its relationship to totalitarian ideologies a few years later with the works of Mohammad Ghazali. Mohammad Ghazali recommended, quote, "an economic regimen similar to that which existed in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy," unquote. The moral code is also an important component in this program, which is intended to create the new Muslim man, unquote. The notion of the equality of the sexes is inherently negated by the concept of the supremacy of male social responsibilities. The, quote, natural, unquote, place of the woman is in the home. That, again, by way of review of the corporatist slash fascistic economic philosophy at the core of the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood. It has been whitewashed, so to speak, to be more of a free market slash laissez-faire economic philosophy, but that, as often as not, leads to fascism in the long run after many of the powerful corporate interests wind up screwing themselves, which they often do, and the economy collapses, people freak out, and then somebody has to impose order in order to make the trains run on time. This, again, by way of supplementing what we looked at last week. Now, we're going to turn to some of the economic and macro-political implications of not only the turmoil in the Middle East, but even more importantly, the resulting rise in the price of oil. Now, I guess I should add at this point or interject that, like many people, as I observed the ongoing chaos and warfare and bloodshed in the Middle East, I wouldn't say I exactly took it at face value, but I wasn't looking deeply enough into it, whereas certainly the U.S. misadventure into Iraq appeared to be motivated by oil, and I suspect there's a more complex motivation there than it first appeared. In fact, I have come to believe over a period of time that it is the actual chaos in the Middle East, the violence in the Middle East, the terrorism from Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood, related Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, the ongoing conflicts between the Israelis and the Palestinians and now the Hezbollah, the targeting of Saudi oil infrastructure, and in general, the saber-rattling vis-a-vis Iran on both sides in that confrontation. Looking at that at a superficial level, I think one can miss the point. What I think is really important about that is that it is that very violence and instability itself which is, at a superficial level, leading to a massive increase in the price of oil. But that increase in the price of oil is a profound, an absolutely profound political and economic event, and it is leading to an enormous and what I believe ultimately might prove decisive shift in wealth. It is an enormous transfer of wealth from the coffers of everything and everybody on the face of the earth, because everything and everybody on the face of the earth uses petroleum directly or indirectly, into the coffers of not only the oil companies, but also many of the countries that produce petroleum. And that is a profound event indeed. Suppose one were a criminal. Suppose what you want to do ideally is to mug everything and everybody on the face of the earth. Suppose what you wanted to do was to basically stick a gun in the face of everyone on earth and say, give me your money, give me your wallet. Well, obviously you couldn't do that in the most literal physical sense. But if you send the price of oil scurrying upward, and boy, it's doing that, and the violence on all sides, Al-Qaeda, the Iraq chaos, the confrontation between Iran and the U.S. and others, the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian violence, and now the Israeli-Hezbollah violence, the effect of that is to create political instability in the Middle East, and the price of oil is soaring, and that increase in the price of oil is resulting in an enormous worldwide transfer of wealth. As I mentioned last week, and time permitting, we'll mention again later, in the early 1970s, the effect of the Arab oil boycott of the early 70s and the resulting price increase for oil, that was a profound economic and political event, and the strain that it placed on the various economies, in particular some of the center-left social democratic governments in Europe, the strain that it placed on everything and everybody, because every individual and every institution, public and private, uses oil, ultimately led to much of the right-wing reaction that swept not only Europe, but ultimately North America as well. Margaret Thatcher would not have come to power in England if it hadn't been for the pressure placed on the British socialist system by the oil price increases. When the strong labor unions in Britain began striking right and left in order to get higher wages to match the greater costs they were incurring all over the place because of the increase in oil. And that increase in the price of oil leads to an inflation across the board, because everything uses oil to transport goods to market and or to manufacture goods. So the price of everything goes up, and when wage earners try to match those price increases with wage increases, it leads to the classic wage price spiral that ultimately helped to bring Ronald Reagan to power in the United States, and it brought Margaret Thatcher to power in England as well. Punk rock was an indirect outgrowth of the Arab oil boycott, because again, the increase in oil prices destabilized many of the center-left social democratic governments of Europe, and the resulting dissatisfaction, despair, and alienation on the part of many young people in those countries, in England in particular, the United Kingdom in particular, led to the form of musical social protest that punk rock was at its inception. So against that background, one should be taking a look at the increase in oil, which is coming from all of this violence and instability, and understand it for the profound, and I suspect ultimately decisive, political factor that it's going to become. We're going to review an article that we looked at last week. This is from the Financial Times of Monday, May 15th of 2006. An article from the Financial Times by Guy Dinmore in Washington. It's headline, U.S. must beware, unquote, rise in Al-Qaeda oil strikes. What this talks about is Osama bin Laden's plan to destabilize the U.S. by destroying its economy through increasing the price of oil. This reads, the U.S. and its Arab allies must expect an increase in attacks on their oil infrastructure in the next phase of the war by Al-Qaeda targeting the U.S. economy, the former Central Intelligence Agency official who was responsible for hunting down Osama bin Laden warns today. Writing for the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington security think tank, Michael Scheuer says Mr. bin Laden's intention to bankrupt the U.S. economy by driving up world oil prices is very likely to lead to attacks inside the U.S. by Al-Qaeda its allies, or unrelated groups. Houston's gas refineries, oil import facilities, and ship canal and pipeline systems, and the Trans-Alaska pipeline are potential targets. Al-Qaeda's failed attack on Saudi Arabia's Abqaiq facility on February 24th, which led to a $2-a-barrel jump in world oil prices, should also be seen as the beginning of a new and more systematic phase of targeting of the kingdom's oil infrastructure. 2 days after the attack, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated cleric issued a religious justification for attacking oil processing installations. The cleric, using the Internet, also claimed that attacks on prominent Muslim oil officials were justified. The militant organization's media apparatus is also being used, quote, to stir the troubled pot of oil-related international worries, unquote, Mr. Scheuer writes, noting encouragement for Nigerian insurgents in the Niger Delta and Mujahideen, unquote, in the Caspian Sea region. Facing Al-Qaeda's evolving strategy, Mr. Scheuer, who left the CIA in 2004, notes that Mr. bin Laden has never threatened to cut oil supplies to the U.S. Instead, he is driven by the belief that Muslim oil is bought too cheaply. In December 2004, Mr. bin Laden wrote that a minimum of $100 a barrel was a fair price, unquote. In his September 1996 Declaration of War Against Americans, unquote, Mr. bin Laden argues that oil in the Islamic world is a treasure to be preserved for future generations of Muslims and thus should not be wasted through attacks. As a result, Mr. Scheuer says Al-Qaeda's plans rule out attacks on oil wells but focus on the infrastructure needed for refining and transporting oil as well as industry personnel. Well, that speaks for itself, and we've read that article into the record last week, and indeed it'll be in the description for 560, which will be going up onto the Spitfire website within the next couple of days. But, again, let me stress that in watching the bloody events unfolding in the Middle East, think beyond the superficial level and think about what this stability, this instability and this violence in the oil-producing epicenter of the world is actually doing. It is leading to a huge increase in oil prices that is not only affecting an enormous transfer of wealth into the coffers of some of the most reprehensible interests on Earth, not only the petroleum companies themselves, but also the Saudis, the Holocaust-denying Iranians, and a lot of others. It is also collapsing, or it is placing greater pressure on those individuals and those institutions least capable of surviving the inflation that results from this. Relatively poor or people of modest income, institutions, nonprofit institutions in particular, ones without a great deal of income, those are going to be, if not pressured, certainly if not eliminated, they are sorely pressured, and ultimately a brutal sort of economic, petroleum-driven social Darwinism will take place, in which only those who are strong enough, i.e. rich enough, to afford the increase in the price of oil will survive. And everything and everybody else is going down. So keep that in mind. Sometimes doing this program, we're going to get back to the instability and its effect on the price of oil and the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of that. Sometimes doing this program is surreal. And one of the things, you know, I read a lot of newspapers, and listening to some of the reports about, well, consumer confidence is up, I do not know how anybody could be confident about what's going on in the world economy. Everybody I know is hurting. And any consumer who has confidence is either filthy rich or nuts. There is a very scary but very important column that appeared in the Financial Times of Monday, May 1st of 2006. By the way, younger listeners, the Financial Times is sort of the primary economic journal of the United Kingdom, and it's an important reading source. This is an op-ed column by a Tennessee Democratic congressman, and what he's doing is talking about the difference between America's budget deficit as it's being reported by the administration and the reality of the American budget deficit. It reads in part, "The federal government keeps two sets of books, but the Bush administration only wants you to see one of them. There is the highly publicized President's Budget issued by the Office of Management and Budget, and the almost secret financial report of the United States, unquote, issued by the Department of Treasury. The budget says that the 2005 U.S. fiscal deficit was $319 billion, but the financial report claims it is $760 billion. Which view is correct? Is the deficit a mere 2.6% of gross domestic product and shrinking, as the former OMB director and now White House Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton claims, or an alarming 6.2% of GDP and growing, as John Snow, Treasury Secretary, writes in the financial report? The budget that is hand-delivered to every congressman's and senator's office is calculated on a cash basis. That is, the government only counts dollars as they are received from taxpayers and spent by government agencies. This says the, quote, deficit, unquote, for 2005 was $319 billion. In contrast, the financial report was issued without a press release and measures government activity on an accrual basis, when income is earned or expenses are incurred, although no cash may have yet been transferred. According to the report, the U.S. obligated itself to spend $760 billion more than it collected from taxpayers in 2005, so the net operating cost was $760 billion, skipping down. The budget says that the national debt is $8.2 trillion. The report indicates that the present value of our obligations is more like $49 trillion. That unimaginable sum is how much money we must set aside today to pay the full Social Security and Medicare benefits that Congress has already promised. The budget says Americans' personal share of the national debt is $28,000. The report says it is $156,000. That means that a family of five owes roughly $750,000. As David Walker, U.S. Comptroller General, says, you owe your government the equivalent of a luxury home, only you do not get to live in it. You only get the mortgage. Yes, indeedy. And bear in mind not only the profound elements of connection between the GOP, Grover Norquist, Karl Rove and the Islamic Institute, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but note the synergy of policy. Who's doing a better job of collapsing the U.S. economy? Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden or George Bush? Or are they really both puppets being manipulated, as I believe, by the same elements, the underground Reich, which one banker told the late journalist Paul Manning was the greatest concentration of money power under a single control in all of world history. Think about that, folks, next time you are paying your taxes. Think about it the next time you vote, too. Anyway, we're going to continue with our analysis of the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of the oil price increase in Side 2. This, however, concludes Side 1. Websites, www.spitfirelist.com, a wealth of printed information and audio information there. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery and linked websites. There is a small universe of valuable, invaluable information about fascism and political science, both in audio form and in printed form. Basically, use it or lose it, folks. If you don't read, then you're going to bleed. If you don't study history, the world is a mystery. God knows I've made it easy enough for you to study history, albeit you've got to invest some time. And after, hopefully, you've invested that time, set aside a little more time to disseminate the information to others via the Internet. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 561, Economics 911 Part 2, being recorded on July 16th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 561, titled Economics 911 Part 2. This has been recorded on July 16th of 2006. We're going to plunge right back in and talk about the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of the increase in oil prices. Again, aside from the superficial aspects of this, one should note that the net effect of the instability in the Middle East is to not only drive up the price of oil, but also to effect a massive transfer of wealth. I would note, too, that in addition to, obviously, the transfer of wealth that is going from everything and everybody into the coffers of the oil companies and related interests, elements within the corridors of power who are in a position to do so could cash in mightily on commodities futures by floating information, whether it's a story, say, and this is simply hypothetical, say you want to float a story to Seymour Hersh for The New Yorker about contingency plans to bomb Iran or something similar. Basically, if you can anticipate some of this or float a story that would cause alarm in the petroleum markets, you can go short in the market and make an enormous amount of money. We're going to talk about the fear factor in the rise of oil prices. I disagree in part with some of the things that are said in the article that's about to follow. Yeah, certainly as places like India and China industrialize, there's increasing demand for oil, but there are also growing numbers of oil strikes. When the world's attention was focused on the tsunami, for example, in early 2005, in fact, the Chinese announced an enormous discovery of oil, and they felt that by the time this new field was developed, it would go a long way towards satisfying China's energy needs. That had almost no effect. It wasn't even noticed by most people. But the oil bulls, as they're going to be termed in this article, maintained that the reason why oil price is going up is because of increased demand. Well, the increase in demand isn't going up that damn fast since 2003, but the instability due to all of the violence has sure as hell been soaring, and that, in my considered opinion, is the primary factor here. But let's get into the article itself, and then we'll talk more about it. This is from the Financial Times of Wednesday, July 5th of 2006, article by Kevin Morrison and Stephen Schur. It's called Fear Factor and Soaring Demand Blamed for Crude Price Leap. And it reads in part, since the price of oil began its rocky but seemingly inexorable climb above $40 a barrel in 2003, parenthetically the year in which the U.S. invaded Iraq, continuing, there has been widespread debate about what is driving it. Crude bears have contended higher energy prices are heavily influenced by a risk premium, unquote, amid fears of terrorist or political disruptions to supply. Bulls, conversely, acknowledge a premium but say it's far less important than the soaring demand from developed and developing countries amid ever-tightening supply. So far, the bears have been punished mightily while the bulls have been among the best compensated investors in the world. Clearly, there is some risk premium, says James Melcher, manager of Balestra Capital, a New York-based hedge fund that has notched up strong returns in recent years, in part thanks to energy-related bets. Quote, if the Israeli-Palestinian mess simmers down, Venezuela settles down, and the Iranian situation progresses in a benign way, I think oil will come down to maybe $55 or $60, but it isn't going back to the $40 range. Unquote. There has been no shortage of events to fuel the fear factor. Notwithstanding the failed attack on Saudi Arabia's Abdaiq facility, Nigerian militants closed significant parts of the country's production early this year. There are continued attacks on Iraqi oil infrastructure, and the nuclear standoff continues between Iran and the West, all of which have kept oil traders busy and stoked concerns about future oil supplies, which has helped push oil prices to more than $70 a barrel this week. Well, again, I think in many ways that article speaks for itself. I do not agree with the, quote, bulls, unquote. Yeah, there's increased demand for oil around the world, but it has been, and that has been known for a long time. The fact that India and China were industrializing at a rapid pace has been known for a long time, and yet at the same time, the oil companies, for example, have deliberately restricted refining capacity, driving up the price of gas. They also have not built heavy offshore oil drilling equipment in the quantity that it would be required. And so the result is, and by the way, this is about to take place in the Gulf of Mexico, the result is that oil drilling equipment is being relocated from places like the Gulf of Mexico to areas that will yield a higher return. Well, again, the dominant financial interests in this world certainly know that places like India and China are industrializing at a quick pace, and yet they have deliberately kept down refining capacity. They have not built offshore oil equipment, and that is leading to an increase in not only the price of oil, but the price of gasoline. And that was anticipated, and it is deliberate. Note also that the continued violence in the Middle East is also driving up the price of oil. And again, like many people, initially I was looking at the violence itself as the main story. But increasingly, I'm looking at the economic and consequent political effects of that violence. It is one of the most, I would say it is probably the single most profound economic dynamic in the world today, and it is absolutely going to lead to a hands-on, across-the-board triumph by the most reactionary elements in the world, because everything and everybody, indirectly or indirectly, uses oil. You jack up the price of that, then you have a brutal economic social Darwinism. The, quote, strongest, unquote, i.e. the richest, those best able to absorb the increase will survive. And everything and everybody else, individuals or institutions that can't absorb that increase, are going down. And that, in my opinion, is probably what is intended here. Hence, the look at the big picture of economics and September 11th and related matters. More about the price of oil increase. The Financial Times of April 22nd and April 23rd of 2006 carries this article by Garrett Smythe in Tehran and Guy Dinmore in Washington. Subtitled Iran and the West, it's titled Rising Crude Oil Prices Very Good, says Ahmadi Nejad. Parenthetically, I would note that not only is the president of Iran a Holocaust denier, but the Iranian fundamentalists came to power in the late 1970s after Ayatollah Khomeini basically had his exile in France paid for by the late François Jeannot, one of the most important Nazi spies and financiers. He not only was the banker to the Grand Mufti and somebody who financed the trials of Adolf Eichmann and Klaus Barbie, that is to say François Jeannot, had much to do with the post-war disbursement of Nazi funds, thereby inevitably working with the Bormann Capital Network. He also had much to do with the post-war diaspora of Nazi war criminals. Most importantly, the late François Jeannot was the heir to the political last will and testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And it was he who sponsored the Ayatollah Khomeini in exile in France, and one of Jeannot's proteges, Ahmed Huber, a director of the bank Alpaco, is very, very close to the Iranian mullahs and the Holocaust-denying president of Iran. And that Holocaust-denying president is talking about rising crude oil prices very good. Reads in part this article, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Iran's fundamentalist president, said yesterday rising crude oil prices were very good, unquote, reflecting his belief that events are moving in Iran's favor as Russia appeared to rule out sanctions against Tehran without proof its nuclear program was designed to produce weapons. Oil prices yesterday rose above $75 a barrel on concern that shipments from Iran and Nigeria will be disrupted. The president's remarks will be read in some quarters as a warning to those who advocate action either economic or military against Tehran over its nuclear ambitions, that Iran's position as the fourth largest global oil producer makes it a difficult target. On Thursday, Mr. Ahmadinejad announced Tehran was studying a dual pricing scheme to cushion poor countries against higher oil prices, while countries with hundreds of billions of dollars should pay the real price of oil, unquote. Since becoming president last year, Mr. Ahmadinejad has faced Western condemnation for fiery verbal attacks on Israel, but his support for the Palestinians and egalitarian slogans have courted popularity among many in the Arab and Islamic worlds. His proposal that, quote, poor consumers, unquote, should get lower oil prices plays into that same populism. Again, thinking about all of the instability, about the scary nuclear face-off between the Iranians and the U.S. and others, think about the fact, for example, that the Iranian nuclear capability comes from the AQ Khan network, which was sponsored largely by the Saudi-financed Safari Club, as we looked at, and among other programs, For the Record 556. Do the Saudis benefit from high oil prices? Indeed. Does a crude bear expletive deleted in the woods, so to speak? Well, of course they do. The Saudis, by the way, also are the financial backers of both Hamas and first the PLO and later the Palestinian Authority. And the Iranians are the main backers of Hezbollah, along with a minor, relatively minor role by Syria. And as one looks at the violence now unfolding on the two borders of Israel, where you've got warfare vis-a-vis Israel and Hamas on one side of Israel, and warfare vis-a-vis Hezbollah and Israel on the other, bear in mind that both of those proxy guerrilla groups, those proxy warriors, are being financed by two major oil producers who stand a great deal to gain from the instability because it drives up the price of oil and increases their profits. Remember that. Another fascinating thing that is taking place vis-a-vis the enormous increase in oil prices, and in turn, as countries are paying tremendous amounts of wealth to the oil-producing countries, that oil wealth is being recycled into investment in countries like the United States. One of the things that's very interesting to me, a lot of the reactionary elements in this country are taking up the old Nazi saw about Jewish control of the news media, because the New York Times has a lot of Jewish editors. But in fact, that is not the case. Not only are Jews not controlling the media in this country, but to a large extent, the Saudis are controlling the news media in this country. Let's take a look at some of the largest media corporations in the world. The largest media corporation in the world is AOL Time Warner, which has a controlling minority interest wielded by a consortium of Saudi princes, chiefly Prince Al-Waleed, one of the richest men in the world, who owns something like a little more over 1% of AOL Time Warner stock by himself. By the way, that doesn't sound like a lot to the uninitiated, but with one of these giant corporations owning when 2% or more of their stock changes hands in a single day, that's viewed as something of a run on its stock and can have a disproportionately large effect on depressing the price of the stock. So when you own even 1 or 2% of one of these giant corporations, it's a lot. The largest media corporation in the world is AOL Time Warner, controlled by a consortium of Saudi princes. Second largest media corporation in the world is News Corp, owned by Rupert Murdoch, but the second largest investor in News Corp and its Fox News subsidiary, which, by the way, reinforces the policies of the Bush administration, which in turn reinforces the instability, which in turn drives up the price of oil, which in turn puts money into the coffers of the Saudis. The second largest investor in News Corp behind Rupert Murdoch is Prince Al-Waleed. Prince Al-Waleed is heavily invested in Disney. Specifically, he bailed out at Disney's Euroworld. And ABC Disney is the third largest media corporation in the world. Other Middle Eastern oil-producing countries also have wielded tremendous capital influence within major corporations. The tiny little, at least in terms of numbers, Kuwaiti Investment Authority owns 7% of Daimler Chrysler. The Kuwaiti Investment Authority is the largest investor in Aventis, the largest pharmaceutical company in the world. The Iranian government has something like a 5 to 7% interest in the ThyssenKrupp, the largest heavy industrial group in Europe. So again, as one contemplates the increase in oil prices, bear in mind that as the capital is channeled into those oil-producing countries, they are recycling it and buying influence in other countries, both with corporations and with nonprofit organizations. There was something of a brouhaha earlier this year when a couple of professors named a couple of professors at Harvard published an article initially in a British publication talking about the Israel lobby and its deleterious effect on American policy, and this produced sort of the predictable response where some people said, yeah, it's about time. People talked about that, and then other people said, well, that's anti-Semitic, etc. But what people did not pay attention to was that a couple of months before these two professors published their paper on the Israel lobby and saying it's time for the U.S. to cut it loose, Prince Al-Waleed made a $20 million donation to Harvard University to promote, quote, Muslim-Christian understanding, unquote. And that, in turn, followed the appointment of an Oxford-educated Middle Eastern gentleman. I believe he was Saudi. He might have been from India, but I believe he was an Arab of Oxford and British educational extraction. He was basically put in charge of investments for Harvard University, which has a lot of money. Then Prince Al-Waleed donates $20 million to Harvard, and then two professors say, gosh, it's time we did something about the Israel lobby. Public opinion, to a large extent, is a commodity, and it can be bought. Prince Al-Waleed also made a $20 million donation, or a big donation, to Georgetown University. And the Saudis are funding Middle Eastern studies programs at major American universities, even as their own population continues to be roughly 50% illiterate. So pay attention to not just the increase in oil prices, but also the resulting effect as that oil wealth that's flowing into these Middle Eastern oil kingdoms is reinvested in the corporate landscapes of Western countries, and also in the educational landscape of these countries. It is ultimately, as Ahmed Huber, neo-Nazi and director of Bank Al-Taqwa, said, we will change public opinion, meaning about Israel, in the United States. When it happens, you'll know. And you watch the Saudi investment in major news corporations and major media corporations and in funding Middle Eastern studies programs at universities, promoting, quote, Christian Muslim, not Christian Muslim Jewish, but Christian Muslim understanding at places like Harvard and Georgetown, and you can see what he's talking about. By the way, whenever one criticizes the Saudis, there are always some elements in the so-called progressive sector that accuse one of anti-Arab racism. Let me reiterate that in the late 1990s, the Saudis hired an American neo-Nazi named William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist. So if there's somebody out there who want to cry racism, check that out, okay? Fascinating observation. And this, what I'm about to talk about, hovers at the very edge of my own understanding of corporate and financial matters. But there is someone who chooses to remain anonymous. This is a former investigator for the Securities and Exchange Commission, a brilliant individual, and someone who also works in the counterterrorist advisory field. And this is a truly brilliant individual, and someone who I perhaps maybe sounds like bragging, but has a high regard for my own work. And this person who chooses to remain anonymous emailed me some things, and here's what he had to say. The Wall Street Journal of Friday, May 26th of 2006, had an article, Saudis Seek Bank of China Stake, and it reads in part, new shares issued by the Bank of China raised $9.7 billion, constituting 10.5% of its enlarged capital share. $2 billion U.S. dollars were invested by Prince Al-Waleed's Al-Azia, leading the group, with Ma'an bin Abdul Wahid Al-Sani, Mahadib Group, Olayan Group, Olayan Saudi Investment Company, Bahamden Holding Company, and Amwal Al-Khalej Commercial Investment Company. $2.26 billion Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi, Bank of China Group, and Bank of East Asia Limited, and $5.1 billion of Singapore's Temasek Holdings, UBS, Ogden Gesellschaft, by the way, a key Borman Bank, and the Royal Bank of Scotland, 89.5% government of China. Now, again, that's the Saudis seeking a Bank of China stake. This individual, this former brilliant Securities and Exchange Commission investigator, interpreted this for me as follows. He writes, if the Bank of China has the traditional balance sheet of 10% capital, stockholders' equity and retained earnings, with the classical balance of 20% outside debt and 10% accruals and 60% deposits, Chinese government, and the stockholders' equity is $90 billion U.S., that means they can lend at least $90 billion per customer, which means they can own any number of governments around the world, their entire central banks. I see the role of Al-Waleed, UBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi, to be one of sweet talk, unquote, to encourage governments to borrow from the Bank of China, where the bank could then exercise tremendous influence over those governments. In the international community, they are likely as not as interested in consumer lending outside of China, and I don't know what they charge in interest for domestic loans, as I've not studied the bank in detail yet, but I see the geopolitical purpose as one of serving empire, of which the Saudis are a part. Now, again, this is complicated. This hovers at the very borderline of my own understanding of these things, because I am not a securities and exchange investigator, but tip of the hat to this gentleman who researched this for us and believes that basically, once again, that enormous capital flowing into the coffers of the Saudis is going to lead once again to control by that extremely reactionary element of a great deal of what is left of our world. Now, another thing that I've noted in connection with the increase in oil prices is the fact that as oil has become more expensive, it has led to something that I had predicted, which was the resuscitation of the old Fischer-Tropsch hydrogenation process that was developed by IG Farben in the 1920s, and that was the focal point of the standard IG agreement of 1929. I've talked about that at great length and among other programs, For the Record 506, For the Record 552, and in one of the sort of Dave Emery Goes Out on a Limb broadcast, For the Record 385, called Formula for Disaster, I analyzed the book The Formula. The Formula is a novel by Steve Shagan that was made into a major motion picture starring Marlon Brando and George C. Scott. What the novel is about a formula for a catalyst developed by I.G. Farben during World War II. In the novel, it's called the Mangan Catalyst, that then becomes the focal point for intrigue in the post-war world as powerful interests vie either to access that formula or to keep it secret. And what ultimately turns out is that the oil companies themselves were trying to keep, the oil cartel was trying to keep that formula secret so that it would not represent a threat to their naturally produced petroleum. In For the Record 385, and I'm encapsulating it here, I voiced my opinion that in fact this novel, as is sometimes the case, was fact presented as fiction because the facts were too controversial. Some people may have seen the movie 3 Days of the Condor, starring Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. In that movie, Robert Redford plays a CIA analyst codenamed the Condor, who reads fiction and then analyzes it and sends that to Langley in order to basically ferret out from fiction things that are actually taking place. That is actually something that does occur within the intelligence community, and I believe that The Formula by Steve Shagan is just such a book. It's fact. More or less presented as fiction, because the facts are too controversial to be published in a journalistic nonfiction context. And one of the things that I noted in the book The Formula and in the description for, well, both the actual broadcast and For the Record 385, I noted the confrontation between Adam Stiefel, played by Marlon Brando, the head of a major oil company, and Barney, who was a retired LAPD detective played by George C. Scott, who was used by the oil companies to basically hunt down some people who were threatening to release the Mangan catalyst, thereby upsetting the cartel. And in that confrontation, George C. Scott says, "We will manufacture synthetic fuel, and in great quantity. We already own most of the coal in the country. We know what's coming. We have the formula. We have the Mangan catalyst, and we have the technology. But we must be certain of profit." By the way, the book was published in 78. "By 1990, the country will be on its knees to OPEC. The government will then turn to us, and in their desperation, they will ensure our profit position in the manufacture of synthetic fuel." Well, as I noted in For the Record 552, that is exactly what is taking place. And note that among the effects of the increase in the price of oil is to make the hydrogenation process, the Fischer-Tropsch process, the focal point of the standard IG agreement, viable once again to the great profit of those who control the process. Yet another article in that context, the Financial Times of Wednesday, July 12th of 2006, has the following article by Richard McGregor. It's titled, Shell Alaai's $5 billion coal-to-oil fuel plant in China. Royal Dutch Shell and a Chinese partner committed yesterday to a 3-year study of a coal-to-liquid fuel plant in western Ningxia province, which if it went ahead would be one of China's largest foreign investments. Lim Ha Kuang, executive chairman of Shell in China, said a plant of the size envisioned would cost between $5 and $6 billion to build, although Shell said this was a preliminary estimate and should not be taken as a guide to the final cost. The Shell joint venture is part of an investment surge into coal-to-liquid plants in China, driven by a combination of the country's abundant coal, rising energy demand, and, surprise, surprise, record oil prices. Just under 30 such projects are in the detailed planning or feasibility stage, according to a report by Credit Suisse, with a projected output equivalent to 10% of the country's present oil demand. The costly capital-intensive CTL plants are generally considered to be financially viable when oil prices are above $35 to $40 a barrel, which the industry thinks is a good bet. Of course, that happened in 2003 when they went up permanently, basically, over that. That was the year that we invaded Iraq. You don't suppose there might have been a connection there, do you? Nah. Coal is China's, quote, real strategic energy reserve, says the Credit Suisse report, because it could all be sourced locally rather than imported. China has another 30 coal-to-methanol plants being built or going through the approval process. That also, by the way, is the same variant of the Fischer-Tropsch process. And skipping down, in the last paragraph of the article, the technology to turn coal into gas and oil was invented in the 1920s in Germany, where it was used to make fuel for the armed forces in the Second World War. That is exactly what I was predicting in For the Record 385. And I want to note, reviewing very briefly something from For the Record 552, guess what took place? Well, what came to light recently? They have, some researchers in the U.S. have developed, surprise, surprise, a catalyst which makes the Fischer-Tropsch coal-to-liquid process much, much more efficient and thereby, quote, viable, unquote. Can you imagine such a thing? This following article, and I'm going to excerpt it briefly, is from Technology Review, Clean Diesel from Coal by Kevin Bullis from Technology Review of April 19th of 2006. It reads in part, as the cost of oil soars and worries over the U.S. dependence on foreign petroleum escalate, coal is becoming an increasingly attractive alternative as a feedstock to make a range of fuels. Now, chemists have invented a new catalytic process that could increase the yield of a clean form of diesel made from coal. The method described in the current issue of the journal Science uses a pair of catalysts to improve the yield of diesel fuel from Fischer-Tropsch synthesis, a nearly century-old chemical technique for reacting carbon monoxide and hydrogen to make hydrocarbons. The mixture of gases is produced by heating coal. Although Germany used the process during World War II to convert coal to fuel for its military vehicles, FT synthesis had generally been too expensive to compete with oil. But now that oil has increased so much in terms of price, and with this catalyst, surprise, surprise, now it's viable. Told you so. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 561, Economics 911 Part 2, being recorded on July 16th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.